This is your Uncle Don back with the 275th edition of My Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Rebroadcasts may be heard on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake. On the 17th of February, 1962, there was a storm in Hamburg, West Germany, in which 300 people perished, but this did not affect me. This date was important in my life, as it was a day in which nothing happened. I awoke in an army barracks in occupied Panama. I ate breakfast in a mess hall, went to work as a supply specialist in the 134th Ordnance Detachment, DSGS, Hawk. After work, I probably ate my supper, kicked around Fort Clayton, drank a beer or two, and went to bed. It was a day in my life that was totally unremarkable, and, for that reason, it was remarkable, as this was the day when I had awaited for 3 years. It was to have been the day of my separation from the United States Army. That storm in Hamburg didn't affect my life, but an event in Germany 6 months previously did. That's when the Berlin Wall was constructed. President Kennedy flew into a snit, going nose-to-nose with the Soviet Union over it. He issued an executive order suspending all separations from the American armed forces, thereby building its numerical strength as recruiting conscription continued. Since the U.S. Army, like all militaries, is an authoritarian organization, no one bothered to tell those directly affected, those whose plans included a timely return to civilian life. I learned of Kennedy's decision via Time magazine. As the weeks wore on and more men were subjected to this involuntary extension of service, morale plummeted. The level of bitching rose above normal levels, and graffiti reading FTA proliferated. The Army pretended this acronym referred to fun, travel, and adventure, the glories promised in recruiting propaganda. To those of us in uniform, FTA had a different meaning. I'd thought that my contract with the United States government contained certain guarantees, and I was correct. Unfortunately for me, all of the guarantees were on the other side, and I, like my peers, had the status of government property. Today's recruits into service in the U.S. military are not as ignorant as I was, or at least they should not be. Today's military recruitment contract, which they sign, contains a clause reading, "In a time of war, my enlistment may be extended without my consent for the duration of the war and for 6 months after its end." Considering that the undeclared war on terror is open-ended, and presidential hopeful John McCain says that the U.S. Army may be fighting in Iraq for 100 years, a signature on one of these contracts could amount to a lifetime of indentured servitude. It seems that slavery in the United States has not been abolished, at least if one volunteers to be the slave. For those of you who pore over American law, Title 10, E, Part 2, Chapter 1209, Section 12305A, will be familiar. It reads, "The President may suspend any provision of law relating to promotion, retirement, or separation applicable to any member of the armed forces who the President determines is essential to the national security of the United States." In 1973, President Nixon suspended military conscription, which had hung like a sword of Damocles over the head of every able-bodied young American man. This draft had been the goad leading me and millions of other men to enlist in a service and at a time convenient to us, rather than waiting to be snatched from job and loved ones when least expected. When the draft ended, recruitment among those with good prospects in civilian life fell precipitously. While the formal draft ended, the economic draft continued. Wages were increased and recruitment efforts among the poor redoubled. The military has always been a lure for those trying to escape the poverty of Appalachia and the ghettos of America. Recruiters promise prospects education, training, and various benefits. They fail to emphasize that those signing on the line may be sent to foreign wars again and again, as those returning for more tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan have learned. Under George Wanker Bush, conscription for involuntary service in the military has resumed, but not among the former victims of all classes. Bush is applying it to individuals in society with the least rights, rights less than those of the millions of prisoners in American jails. He's using that power embodied in the aforementioned enlistment contracts and war powers legislation to draft from within the existing military. he's invoked the so-called stop-loss program, by which current fighters have their voluntary enlistments extended into involuntary servitude at the pleasure of the chief executive. Members of the U.S. military are not covered by civilian rights and privileges. There's a set of laws called the Uniform Code of Military Justice, a compendium of rules that, in essence, give the government draconian control over its enlisted men and women. The quaint contents of this UCMJ are being used to persuade and prosecute these poor devils, including our own Omar Khadr in Guantanamo and the gulag of American prisons, secret and otherwise, around the world. I experienced the application of the UCMJ during my brief stint as a prison chaser or temporary guard in an army barracks in Panama. This institution was a jail on our base for offenders serving sentences of 6 months or less for petty offenses to that Uniform Code of Military Justice. The prisoners I supervised were guilty of heinous crimes, like insubordination toward the officer class or other minor stuff. For these offenses, they were sentenced to imprisonment under Article 15. Article 15 gave an officer the power to unilaterally convict any enlisted man and sentence him to jail for up to 6 months while confiscating 2/3 of his pay. Time served in a military stockade was not counted toward enlistment time, but time served was added to the length of enlistment. Article 15 sentences were subject to appeal, but the process was convoluted and I never heard of one success. While guarding these dangerous felons, my fellow soldiers, I was issued a riot shotgun and 5 rounds of double-aught buckshot. If one of my charges attempted to run, I was to shoot him. In preparation for my duties, I was trained in the use of this weapon. On the firing range, my third shot at a heavy silhouette target blew it in half. When working with my charges, I carried these shells in my pocket. I was not about to kill a man for insubordination to an arrogant officer. As of the date of this broadcast, the world has another 189 days in which to hold its collective breath while a superstitious, deluded maniac holds the power to reduce our world to rubble. We tend to forget that George Bush is never far from the briefcase containing that red button that can launch thousands of bombers and missiles, delivering the most devastating weapons devised by man. If that button is ever pushed, the destruction would be so widespread that it would not matter in the long run where those hydrogen bombs are targeted. The population of the world would be decimated, if not annihilated, in the aftermath. Might he actually do it? Might his narrow mind reach a point, as he sees his days of unlimited power waning, where his delusions drive him to precipitate that Armageddon that his Bible tells him will fulfill its prophecy? We would like to believe that there are those in the chain of command with enough sense and integrity to countermand orders from the commander general that would devastate the planet. But are there? If so, where were these people when Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq based on patently false presumptions? I'm afraid that the current American regime, from the private soldiers to Supreme Court judges, have been purged of individuals of conscience, possessing the means and will to thwart this rogue regime of militarism, violence, fear, and torture. Human beings the world over, not least of which live in the United States, are staking their hopes on replacement of the Bush regime with one that will lead us back from the brink of multiple worldwide crises. I wonder whether the United States, weakened in will and power by 7.5 years of Bush, is capable of regaining the ability to change for the better in the short run. If men and women of conscience have truly been purged, and the population has been so cowed by fear, can any leader turn his America around, pulling back from its bullying militarism? Is there a momentum there that could resist the most valiant efforts of good men and women? Behind the facade of a massive military, financed by a full half of the total spent by the world on combat forces, is a deteriorating economy and an unprecedented massive debt. With the burden of Bush's multi-trillion-dollar public debt, unmanageable private debt, and a declining dollar, it's doubtful that the new president will have the economic ammunition to make drastic changes. And would either of the two surviving presidential candidates have the will to bring about real change? It appears that John McCain does not intend to make any serious difference. He professes to want to soften the hard edges of American policy, but we know that his every statement is tailored to heighten his chances of election, and the truth be damned. It reminds me strongly of our own dear Harper regime in this regard. As to Obama, it looks like the election 4 months hence is his to lose, unless the right-wingers succeed in portraying him as a dangerous radical or he makes some serious blunders. In just over a half a year, we will see the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Obama mobilized an army of supporters and a fortune in contributions from those to whom he promised real change in America. Now that the nomination is his, he's following a path common to politicians. He's backing away from those positions that garnered that support as he plays to the center-right. His brain trust assumes that, with the opposition being the right-wing McCain, the left is his, so he can afford to discard any stands that smack of radicalism to the masses. Gradually, he's coming forth as just another opportunist, willing to take the reins of power and staying to well-worn ruts of the status quo. Gone are pledges to renegotiate NAFTA. Gone is the promise to bring a swift end to the occupation of Iraq. I fear that the 20th of January 2009 will see the new president carrying on the same tired policy set by Bush. May I be wrong in this? Please let me be wrong. We're supposed to be celebrating the dramatic rescue of hostages from the FARC rebels in Colombia. Yes, a number of souls held for years by this bunch were whisked from the jungles of that sad country by helicopter. But the news reports don't seem to hold together. The prisoners were herded together on the pretext that the guerrillas would be transferring them to a different place. A Colombian army helicopter, with Colombian soldiers masquerading as guerrillas, plucked the hostages from enemy grasp and flew them to freedom without a shot being fired. The first odd thing seems to be the revelation that these guerrillas have helicopters, and helicopters that can be confused with those of the Colombian army. Guerrilla communications were so muddled that infiltrators could convince them that a mass transfer of prisoners was sanctioned. A front-page Globe and Mail photo of Ingrid Betancourt, a former candidate for president, held for 6 years in jungle hideouts, shows her finely coiffed while wearing a wristwatch and jewelry. Do women look like this after living rough in the jungle for years? Not only were the guerrillas fooled into believing that a government helicopter was their own and that high-profile prisoners were decked out and groomed to be shuffled off to an unknown location, but that the whole thing was videotaped for television. Does this smell like the much-vaunted release of poor Jessica Lynch from the hands of evil Iraqi doctors? That dramatic rescue was later revealed by none other than Lynch herself as a totally staged, phony operation for the television cameras. Those Iraqi doctors had tried to turn Jessica over to the U.S. military, only to be repulsed at gunpoint. Then the troops, facing no resistance, stormed the hospital, kicking in doors and firing weapons to claim the poor hostage. Total bullshit. I think this whole Colombia rescue was likewise bullshit. Venezuela's Chavez had been working to secure the release of those hostages, and I suspect that they were not rescued, but released. There are rumors that a ransom had been paid. Of course, the Americans and Colombians could not admit that they had been negotiating with the guerrillas, nor that Chavez had a hand in the release. Therefore, they had to clothe the whole operation in the disguise of a rescue so that the Colombian military looked good and Chavez's operations were marginalized. It may seem that such a blatant set of lies would be too much even for the Colombian and American governments to concoct, but look at the Rescue Lynch farce. Look at President Johnson's fabricated North Vietnamese attack on American ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, another total set of blatant lies. No, I don't believe anything so odd as what we have been told in this impeccable rescue. Later on, after this is old news, we'll probably learn the truth, truth that will be allocated to the back pages and ignored. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. What good is a war and occupation if someone doesn't profit from them? Canadian corporations are beginning to reap rewards from the sacrifice of over 80 Canadians and untold locals in Afghanistan. The United States has allowed Cameco Corporation to purchase, at deep discount, a store of 550 tons of yellowcake uranium from Iraq. This asset of the Iraqi people was spirited to the island of Diego Garcia by the U.S. military, from which it was shipped to Canada. The undisclosed price paid is alleged to be in the tens of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, the market value of this yellow cake is around $72 million. Make no mistake, this discount sale of Iraqi assets was a reward for our aiding the U.S. in their war against Afghanistan. News reports told us the Iraqis were looking for a buyer, with the guidance of the U.S. State Department. Guidance, eh? There's another example of the bullshit that makes its way into the papers. They're claiming this disposal has provided revenue to the Iraqis. And which Iraqis? The puppets whose tenuous role is dependent on American arms and soldiers. Today the uranium, tomorrow the oil. Does anyone still have the temerity to claim that this war in Iraq is not about oil? Control of Iraq's vast oil resources is a prize to be granted aggressors in this war, even if victory is not achieved in conventional terms. Warlords may control most of the countryside, but as long as U.S. troops are there to guard the oil for American SUVs, all will be well. Canada shoulders a terrible embarrassment. We have the minority leader of our government so solidly and transparently in the pocket of a discredited foreign leader that he has little claim to represent our country. He dares not oppose any of that other country's policies or actions, even as the leader he so assiduously sucks up to is headed for the trash heap of history in half a year. Stephen Harper is alone among Western heads of state in not supporting one of our own citizens held in the torture camp of Guantanamo Bay. Disregarding international agreements as to child soldiers, he has aided and abetted the imprisonment and mistreatment of a 15-year-old boy. Yes, the boy was involved in combat. He may, or may not, have thrown a hand grenade that killed an American soldier. But he was under siege, and all but one of his companions was dead at the time of the assault. A good case for self-defense seems apparent. In any case, Stephen Harper made no attempt to ameliorate the conditions of Omar Khadr. Many, if not most, Canadians believe that American soldiers are participating in war crimes in Iraq during an illegal occupation. If Harper held the precedent set by better men, we would be giving sanctuary to soldiers refusing to violate international law. Instead, our fearless leader is pulling levers to extradite sending refugees back to the tender mercies of U.S. military. This was revealed just in today's news. Harper did not initiate their complicity in the invasion of Afghanistan, but he's been the prime drumbeater for an escalation of hostilities. He committed billions of dollars and thousands of soldiers in a fight that cannot be won unless NATO puts a soldier on every street corner in the country. What interest is it of Canada's that this war, a war that has outlasted both World Wars I and II, continue? Will this eliminate terrorism in the world? Not likely, as the planet's greatest purveyor of terror is our prime ally. Will it eliminate the Taliban? No. The Taliban is not a separate force that can be excised like a cancer. It is intimately integrated with the population, and nothing short of genocide will see the end of it. The sole reason for our engagement in that far-off land, now under occupation by an international force that supposedly exists to protect Western Europe from a defunct Soviet Union, is the will of George Wanker Bush. No nation wants to supply the 20,000 more men to serve as cannon fodder for the ego of George Bush and his cherished oil pipeline. Now the bugger Bush wants to foment a war between Iran and Israel, a war that an indignant United States will be forced to join by treaty with Israel. Would Harper have the temerity to join his idol and get our nation embroiled? I shudder to contemplate the consequences. What would be the long-run outcome of our admitting defeat in Afghanistan? Or perhaps we could declare victory and retreat with our tails between our legs, as the U.S. did in Vietnam. Would it matter? We're told that our absence would lead the nation of Afghanistan's falling apart. Wrong. Afghanistan has never been a unified nation. It's a loose conglomeration of feudal states with an alleged national government having little influence outside of Kabul. We're told that Afghan narcotics would flood the world markets and turn all of our children into junkies. Too damned late, with that country under a puppet government already supplying over 90% of the world's illicit heroin. We could stem the flood of opium by sending in buyers to purchase it at better prices than those offered by gangsters, putting the magic of the market to work, and thus alleviating the world shortage of painkillers. We could emasculate the whole illegal network from the farmers' fields to the streets of Vancouver, and it would cost precious little compared to what Canadians are now spending on manpower and equipment to fight an endless war. A hidden reason for fighting this war was to establish a safe route for a pipeline that would circumvent Russian control. Would a Taliban government or a coalition of warlords thwart that goal? Not if we paid them to guard it. Afghans are as greedy as the next guys, and they would do the work of mercenary guards gladly. So what's the reason for continuing endless war against Afghanistan? Is it really to punish those behind the suicide hijackings of 19 dead men, none of which was Afghan? Or was it just a prelude to Bush's attack on Iraq, an attack which is now becoming clear was for oil in spite of all denials? Israel and Iran are nose-to-nose, and Western propaganda mills are in high gear. Look at the facts. Israel conducted an exercise with 100 warplanes and refueling tankers scooting 1,400 kilometers in a mock attack. That's just about the distance from Israeli bases to Iran's nuclear facilities. This was presented to us as a routine defensive operation. Days later, Iran tested several missiles, but this was not portrayed as an exercise. This was a dangerous escalation of tensions and a direct threat to Israel. I've heard no reports considering the two events as anywhere near equal. Israel, good guys. Iran, bad guys. Everything for public consumption is viewed through this lens. Here's a fact. Israel is a creature of the United States. The U.S. was instrumental in its creation on Palestinian land and remains its most fervent supporter. Israel is the largest recipient of American foreign aid. Israel's military is stuffed with American equipment, supplied gratis. Israel's foreign policy is dictated by Washington, and they dare not deviate far from the path of American wishes. But this relationship is symbiotic. Governments of the United States, Democratic and Republican alike, must fervently support Israel, right or wrong. It's impossible to overestimate the power of the Israel lobby in the U.S. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee is one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. With the support of a huge bloc of Jewish voters, now joined by many Christian fundamentalists, Israel can swing important American elections. This de facto alliance of Jews and evangelicals is due to biblical interpretations of the latter. Supposedly, the existence of Israel is one precondition for the promised Armageddon. Without Israel, the faithful will not be raptured into space to oversee the punishment of the heathens left behind. Will Israel attack Iran? Don't look to Israel or its politics for an answer. Look to Washington and the lame duck Bush's quest for mayhem. Would Bush order an Israeli attack on Iran? Would he authorize the Israelis to use those nuclear weapons they deny having? Stay tuned. Meanwhile, keep your gas tank filled. A war in the Middle East involving Iran could well shut down oil exports for a long time. Don't like that 2.5-cent carbon tax on your gas? Try a $5 a liter premium and actual shortages at the pumps. George Wanker Bush has the fate of the entire world's economy in his hands for the next 6 months, and there's no limit to the mayhem he can cause. Leave it to the military to come up with cutesy names for terrible things. Take the frequent flyer program inflicted on those poor bastards in Guantanamo. Another way of softening up prisoners for interrogation is the moving of them from one cell to another every 3 hours around the clock. Torment or torture? The borderline seems fluid. I personally have a way of defining the difference. If I would find any treatment to be intolerable, I consider it torture. I think back to the days when I stayed up around the clock in an all-nighter preparing for exams. I was not worth much the next day and soon learned that a good night's sleep was a better foundation for good grades than facts crammed into a dozy head. How would I fare if moved to a different cell every 3 hours, subjected to constant bright lights and loud music? Would I consider that I was being tortured? Omar Khadr was tortured for information, period. Canadian officials questioned Omar after he had been subjected to this torture for weeks, and they knew of this torture. Those officials were complicit in torture of a Canadian citizen and should be prosecuted in Canadian courts for that crime, as defined in our criminal code. Then there's the issue of waterboarding, a term dreamed up to bring forth the image of water skiing or snowboarding. We know it is like neither. American Special Forces recruits have been waterboarding, and a brief introduction to the practice had everyone begging for mercy. Christopher Hitchens, American columnist and supporter of the Iraqi occupation, volunteered to be waterboarded. he came out unequivocally and pronounced waterboarding to be torture. While the practitioners of this brutal practice say that it simulates drowning, Hitchens declared that it is drowning from which he, the victim, is revived. This drowning arouses involuntary primal fears and reactions. It's among the worst of tortures in his practice, with sanction coming right from the White House. If it is not torture, let George Bush and Dick Cheney, for starters, volunteer for Sessions. After Bush is ejected from the White House, let us hope that he finds himself in the dock at The Hague, confronting charges for his war crimes, including torture. Fat chance. But enough of today's war crimes. Let me look back at the crimes of the generation when I was young. Back when I first came to Canada, and one of the principal reasons for my choosing Canada, the Vietnam War was raging. Lyndon Johnson ran amok with that war, much as George Bush the Lesser is now doing in Iraq. The Vietnamese, like the Iraqis now, violently resisted an American-imposed puppet government. Back then, the terror weapons of choice for the invaders were the B-52 bombers, carpet bombing, almost at random, napalm, and the notorious Agent Orange. Agent Orange was a potent universal defoliant sprayed by air on villages, farms, jungles hiding resistance soldiers of the National Liberation Front and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a network of roads and paths down which supplies were transported from the north. By defoliating the jungles, aircraft could spot and bomb troops and supplies. By spraying farms and rebel areas, they deprived the people of food. Agent Orange worked like a dream for the Yanks and a nightmare for the Vietnamese, resistors and collaborators alike. This hellish mix is heavy on dioxin, a toxic chemical that disrupts biological functions in doses of parts per billion. American aircraft dropped 80 million liters of this poison on a prostrate population. Those 80 million liters of Agent Orange contained the equivalent of 366 kilograms of pure dioxin. Laboratory tests indicate that dioxin, when present in the amount of 1/1000th of a gram per kilo of body weight, can cause birth defects and reproductive failure in animals. Vietnamese are humans, and humans are animals. Vietnam estimates that 400,000 people were killed or maimed by Agent Orange. 500,000 children were born with defects, and 2 million have suffered cancers or other illnesses above and beyond what would normally be expected incidences in the population. Today, as many as 3 million living Vietnamese suffer the residual effects of this poison. Chemical warfare is an international crime, but the world's leading purveyor of violence cared little for the niceties of international law or treaties. Some things never change, eh? While the U.S. government has spent many millions, perhaps billions, in compensation and medical care for its own soldiers affected by exposure to Agent Orange, the total amount offered to its Vietnamese victims was $3 million, one lousy Yankee dollar per person affected. The United States has never admitted that its invasion of Vietnam was unjustified. The world knows this, but not Americans. They will wave the bloody shirt, claiming that they had been hard done by ungrateful Vietnamese. Just last month on our Yukon trip, we saw a U.S.-licensed motorcycle whose owner had one of those insipid POW-MIA stickers on his helmet left over from the Vietnam War. A third of a century after the end of that war, some Americans still think that they were victims, as some of their soldiers were never accounted for. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, of the Vietnamese disappeared, cremated alive by napalm, shredded by carpet bombing, murdered in dungeons by their Vietnamese puppet sadists. But they mattered not, as some precious American soldiers were unaccounted for. And so it goes. Agent Orange has been forgotten, for Americans at least. The weapon of choice in American invasions today is so-called depleted uranium. Therein lies another cutesy euphemism, this one covering the fact that uranium is no more depleted than Agent Orange was depleted dioxin. This has been your Uncle Don presenting my 275th Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, rebroadcast on CGLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Support your local U.S. military deserters. They deserve it.